動でお風呂を沸かします。
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Covent Garden. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Anna Tyshinsky, Andrew Hunter Murray, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days, and in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that in 1910, the World Health Organization tried to ban kissing.
Wow. You think that'd be a bigger story given such a huge organization, right?
Especially as it happened 30 years before they existed.
Yes.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
What's going on here?
If you listen very carefully, you will have heard me say the World's Health Organization as opposed to the more commonly known World Health Organization. And this was an organization, and when I say an organization, I mean really one woman in America called Imogene Rectin. And she decided that everyone should stop kissing. And she got in all the newspapers and invented a load of badges and pledges and stuff like that. And really thought that if people stop kissing, then maybe we could stop the spread of disease, things like consumption, typhus, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
She kind of been completely wrong. If everyone stopped kissing everyone else, we'd have fewer diseases.
Yeah.
Well, we did try it for half a year in 2020, if you remember.
And no one got a cold. So, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying maybe the cost is greater than the benefit.
Yeah, I feel like she was almost ahead of her time understanding then about exchange of possible germs. I mean, our mouths are rank. They've got like billions of bacteria in them. Yeah. I know a lot of them are probably good bacteria.
Yeah.
But I think there was a study done that had people drink a Yakult or a probiotic drink and then had them snog their partner. And they found that 80 million bacteria transferred from one face to the other.
Bacteria is tiny though.
Yeah, 80 million. Feels like
we don't know how much that is, do we?
Is there ever a thing where it's like, oh, three bacteria transfers? Like, it's going to be big, right?
It's such a good point.
Even if three bacteria transferred, before long, there's going to be more than, there's going to be four, five,
there
six,
you go.
Seven.
That's true.
Yeah,
there you go.
They are rampant.
She does sound amazing.
Yeah.
Imogene as well. Imogene.
Weirdly, some newspapers call her Imogene, but I think they might be misprints because most of them say Imogene.
She got not a lot of support. She got some support. She got 1,000 acolytes, which I think is a good hit rate for this slightly
it's a
demented
good number
campaign.
Of acolytes.
Yeah. Well, including 70 brides who declined to be kissed at their own weddings.
Really?
Which I think, Yeah.
You may now kiss a bride. No, you may not.
Yeah.
So in the article that you sent over, James, when you found this, there was a nice little thing that it starts off by saying that she'd convinced her husband of the risks associated with promiscuous kissing, which sounds like she had a bit of a dog in the race to begin with. Yeah, she had a husband.
So he was a big kisser, right?
I think what it sounds like, reading further into the article, is that kissing on the lips and kissing generally was much more what you just did. If you had parties at the house, everyone would kiss each other on the lips. Women would kiss each other. Men would kiss men.
In 1910.
That's my party.
That's what her husband was telling her anyway. First of all, the keys go in the bowl. Then we start kissing. And then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't think men were snogging each other that much by 1910. There have been phases when the kiss has been in. But I think her husband was spinning it
yarn. I did just throw that in, I have to admit. It definitely said women were kissing women. I thought, men should be kissing men then.
I was in France recently. I was in the south of France. And I was in a particularly kissy region.
Oh, yeah.
It varies from region to region. I saw some people kissing four times.
Oh,
yeah,
but there's more.
Bang, way more.
I think you do get. There are fives, definitely.
I've had a
way
good
more.
Five or
Tell
six.
Tell me where there's a way more. You've had a six.
Yeah,
kiss.
I lived in France for 3 months with my grandmother in 2003. I've had a six. You start counting when it's
six.
Six. I've had a six. Maybe she wanted to give me six.
I've seen a
Your
five.
Your grandmother?
Yeah. No, her oldie mates. All the grannies at the retirement. Maybe they forget. Maybe they forgot.
Halfway through, they're like,
what am I on?
Start again.
You can be stuck in the old people's home for hours, can't you?
Think about older people kissing. This was actually one of Imogene's theories. And she thought that if she could stop older people from kissing each other, and actually more like stopping them from kissing children, then eventually when the older generation died out, so kissing would die out, because the children wouldn't have got it into their system that it's a thing that you do. That was her plan.
That's interesting. Mm. Wow. Probably would have worked if she'd, again, if
she's got more than 1,000 acolytes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's a cultural thing, you know, it's a learned thing.
We assume it is, yeah. I think there's some debate, isn't there? But I think we assume it's a learned thing largely because about just over half of societies don't do it.
Yeah. So the number is 46% do it of cultures that were looked at to see whether lip to lip kissing was a thing.
But what's a culture? As in, is Britain one culture?
No. It's not like Britain. So it's obviously tiny minorities of people because the vast majority of people on Earth do kiss now because we're a globalised society. But if you go to an Amazonian tribe or, you know, Papua New Guinea or something.
Yeah, right.
I think it's particularly uncommon in parts of China, parts of Mongolia. That area is quite uncommon.
So it was 168 cultures from around the world. Okay. And this was a professor of anthropology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Which I assume is a serious university.
Yeah.
I just associate it with gambling. I don't know why.
Poor Las Vegas. It does do other stuff.
Yeah, that university is a very wealthy one, actually, because one year, a few decades ago, they put everything on red. And
exactly.
They've got a huge endowment now.
The first person who kind of observed that a lot of these cultures don't do mouth-to-mouth kissing was a guy called Paul Denjoy. Mm. So it's D apostrophe and then enjoy.
Don't enjoy.
Enjoy.
Such a good name. He said that some people considered it an abomination and a form of cannibalism.
Come on, that's someone kissing too hard.
It's a step on the road to cannibalism. It's a slippery slope.
So just back to Imogen very quickly. I read a lot of newspaper articles about her because in 1910 and 1911, she was everywhere. Obviously, the newspapers saw this story that trying to ban kissing and they loved it. She was known as the foe of occultation. In the press, occultation being another word for kissing. And in August of 1910, she tried to organize a No Kiss August, which, you know, it's like, No Drink January or whatever they call it.
November. Yeah.
I reckon this might be the first of those.
Yeah.
You know, 1910, it must be.
Yeah, that's very early.
But then by 1912, there were no more mentions of her on newspapers.com. So after 2 years, the press weren't interested anymore.
Do we know any more about her story at all? Like, do we know when she died? Or
I know when someone with her name died, but I couldn't tell if it was definitely her. So yeah, I'm not really sure. She kind of went away
Images.
Yeah.
13% of people say they've been accidentally kissed on the mouth at work.
Dan
goes around kissing people on the mouth all the time. No,
but sometimes the turn from comes too
from
sharply.
An air kiss to another air kiss.
Especially when you're doing seven.
I found someone else who has an anti-kissing rule. And it's champion whistlers. Specifically one champion whistler, who's a guy called Christopher Ullman, who I think has won at the International Whistlers Convention. And there are, you know, lots of different kinds of whistling. And he says he has a no kissing rule for 24 hours before a performance.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, he must have a lot of groupies, you know, whistling groupies.
Yeah.
He sounds great. He says it makes your lips mushy, kissing before a performance.
He doesn't
lick his lips, which I'm very impressed by.
God, that's amazing. How they must be dry, parched and dry by the time he's whistling.
But then they must be like a solid whistle, right?
Oh, if you've got dry lips, I think it's very hard to whistle, isn't it?
Is it? What does he say, Andy?
I don't actually know how he moistens them. I've only got other details like he can do Mozart's oboe concerto, the oboe part, but whistling.
Okay.
Which is hard.
I think most people can do any part, right?
Yeah, most people can whistle any tune.
If it's a tune, it's whistleable.
The problem is none of us knows Mozart's
that
oboe
piece.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a very good point.
So when his stooge in the crowd goes, I bet no one here can do that.
And then he does it and everyone's like, is that that?
Is that the, yeah, exactly.
What's that?
Better to do a plane engine, though, or a drill, or,
something
you know...
Something that doesn't sound like a
whistle.
Something
that doesn't sound like a whistle.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What would the point... What was that?
It was a drill.
That was Beethoven's...
All right. Well, we've just casually driven by this guy's whole career.
No, but it's interesting because I... You know, how would
sorry,
you...
it can't be his career.
It's unclear. It's unclear.
I know he's got all these groupies, but really, you're making a living out of that.
They asked him in this interview if his family gets sick of the whistling, and he said, I actually don't whistle around the house very much. Random idle whistling is very annoying.
Yeah. Well, that's someone's told him that a lot of times. In 1921, in the newspapers, there was a worry about people kissing freckled girls on the cheeks. Can you guess why that might be dangerous? This was in the newspapers.
Freckles come off. They go on your lips. You get lip covered in freckles. Can't eat you stuff.
Well, were they thought to be contagious, I guess, is the...
Freckles.
Yeah. Mm. In the 1920s.
Was this a justified thing, or was it a crazy... Okay, so it's justified. Freckled girls.
Because they are out in the sun, so they are wearing what back in the 1920s was radioactive sunscreen.
Yep. You're so close.
Yeah, so the sunscreen had chemicals
no,
in
no,
it.
No, don't carry on with the wrong answer.
Okay, just try radioactive sunscreen, which meant that to kiss them would give radiation and you'd become...
Forget about the radioactive part.
Oh, okay.
It's the being outside part.
No.
Poisonous makeup.
Almost. Basically, there was an anti-freckle medication that people were using to try and get rid of their freckles, and it was toxic if ingested.
Amazing.
And so there was a danger, according to the newspapers, if you kissed a freckled girl on the cheek, you might get sick.
Wow.
God. That's awful, because the girls are going to think that their medication isn't working at all, because still no one's kissing them.
Yeah.
On alternatives to kissing, which people have had to come up with, these poor societies that don't have kissing, Darwin, who met a lot of people in his life, different peoples, listed a bunch of alternatives to kissing in cultures, and he listed rubbing of noses, which Laplanders and New Zealanders do, rubbing or patting of the arms, breasts or stomachs, or one man striking his own face with the hands or feet of another.
Like a slap, proper slap.
It's like, why are you hitting yourself? Yeah. Why are you hitting yourself?
Oh, right.
Oh, actually, it's not you hitting yourself. It's me grabbing your hand and then hitting me in the face with your hand.
You are actually hitting yourself, yeah.
Why are you hitting me? Why are you hitting me?
Yeah, why are you hitting me?
Was that a game? Why are you hitting me?
It was a catchphrase, you could say. Yeah, yeah.
Can I talk about very quickly some other public health stuff?
Yeah.
Especially done by American women. So this is a group of middle class women from Manhattan called the Ladies Health Protective Association. And they basically, there was a huge pile of manure in the middle of New York. Okay.
Okay.
It covered two blocks and stood 30 feet tall.
Oh, I was picturing much smaller when you said there was a pile.
That's incredible.
That's like the Godzilla.
So what they would do is, obviously a lot of horses in those days, right? Yeah. They would collect the manure from stables and they would sell it as fertilizer to farmers who were just outside the city, but they needed somewhere to keep it. And so they just kept it in the middle of the street. It was this guy called, weirdly enough, he was called Michael Caine. But Kane as in Harry Kane with a K.
Right.
But anyway, Michael Caine had this huge manure pile and he was making loads of money. He was making $300,000 a year, which today is about $8 million from this manure pile. And his brother-in-law was a New York State senator, so everyone thought there was nothing they could do about it.
Right.
Anyway, this Ladies Health Protective Association came along and did a court case, and amazingly, they won it. They basically called it a nuisance, and by the law that there was no way that he could get around it because of this technical thing they called it. And not only that, the Board of Health denied any permits for any manure dumps in the whole city. So that's why if you go to New York now, there's not a 30-foot pile.
Yeah. I've always wondered why there's not.
30-foot. God, that's
and this group then turned to spitting. They turned to stop spitting. And that was when New York became the first city in the world that banned spitting.
Mm. Well, isn't it true that in the middle of Central Park there was a massive reservoir of spit? So it's disgusting.
Okay, on with the podcast.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is that after King Charles I was decapitated, he was recapitated.
You just made that word up.
Yeah. So, King Charles I, only king who's ever been executed. I guess loads of them have been killed in battles and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But it was in 1649, and it was just after the English Civil War. And obviously, huge move, you know. Big old move.
Big deal.
Political
big deal.
Chaos, yeah. But the king's body basically had to be seen. And the authorities, the sort of Republican authorities, wanted to say, look, he's definitely dead and he's not coming back. So they employed a surgeon after the execution to stitch the head back on. And
I would have thought that if I'd have seen his body without the head, that would be even more proof that he wasn't alive.
Definitely. What a good point.
It
what
sort of
point.
Looks like he was kind of coming back if the head that's meant to be off was suddenly back on.
Anyway, I should say quickly where I got this from. I've been reading a book. It's actually from a novel. It's called Act of Oblivion.
Ah.
And it's all about the hunt for the regicides.
Is it by Thomas Harris?
No, it's by
Robert Harris.
Robert Harris.
Yeah. And so basically, and it describes in incredibly gory detail the death of the king and also the death of the regicides, who are the people who signed the death warrant and all this, and who really, they really put through the ringer.
Yeah, this is, we should say for international listeners, they didn't put them through the ringer as soon as they'd killed the king. It wasn't like you've executed the king and now we're going to execute you. It was when the restoration happened. Mm. So there was a brief period where everyone was pro-killing the monarchy.
About 10 years.
Then sadly, after a decade, monarchy came back and then all the regicides got hunted down.
Sadly, Anna says, sadly, monarchy came back.
Perspective of a roundhead, I was adopting the character of Oliver Cromwell.
So I don't know anything about Charles I, having not grown up in this country. So I am one of these foreign listeners, as it were, that you mentioned, Anna. And it struck me that what a big deal it was to kill the king off the back of a trial, because there's all this stuff, and Oliver Cromwell is a name that is very much part of the decision to bring him to trial and have him executed.
almost a key player.
Yeah, yeah, and the story gets quite gruesome when we talk about what happened to him and the others some 30 years later after the death.
Only 10 years later.
Sorry, 10 years later.
Okay, so 1649, Charles was killed.
Yeah.
So, and then recapitated, right? 1650, I think it was 8, Oliver Cromwell died after less than 10 years in office. And then 2 years later, the monarchy is restored, 1660. Then, at that point, Oliver Cromwell is dug up and decapitated.
Yeah.
So both Charles and Cromwell had a head-altering situation.
They should have switched them around. Freaky Friday.
Freaky Friday.
It was his son, was it? King Charles II, who was a direct son of Charles I, then was the person in charge of the monarchy once. Yeah,
the person in charge of the monarchy, or the king.
The king.
Well, it's surprising that it disappeared for 11 years. I mean, that is a pretty big deal. Yeah, it wasn't just overthrowing the monarchy, it was overthrowing all of the monarchy.
It was a big deal.
It was one of the biggest things that's ever happened
as
in England's history.
I'm just saying, as a foreigner, you don't follow. Sorry, we're up to date on Charles I.
You haven't lived here for about 20 years now. I feel like you should at some
point. Yeah, it should have been as I was coming to immigration.
Did you not have to do an exam to get into the UK?
No, I'm British.
Well, do you want to know something really interesting? It's not in a lot of the citizenship tests, is or at least a couple of years ago, there was a really good article
on... Should it be question number one?
There was a really good article on History Today about how it wasn't in the test for new immigrants. There was nothing about the Civil War, anything like that, and missed that whole period. And someone asked immigration, why isn't this included? And they said the wounds are still too fresh. So a spokesperson said, the assumption is that we are all anti-Cromwell. Obviously, parliamentarian, didn't believe in the divine right of kings. The reason that Charles I was overthrown was because he really went hard on the divine right of kings as well. He loved it, didn't he? Like, he prorogued parliament for 11 years, didn't want to ask them anything, and then told them to give him loads of money. He was into absolutist monarchy.
And when they put him on trial, he was like, well, you can't put me on trial because God put me here, so...
Yeah. And now I think Cromwell is a bit of a villain to almost everyone. But in another country, he would be a hero. And in fact, in America, he's remembered quite heroically.
He's still got a statue outside of Parliament.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Which is surprising. So he's not... Yeah, and that wasn't toppled in the old topples of statues period that we went through quite recently.
No, it wouldn't be.
After he died, after he died, was dug up and then posthumously re-executed. His body and a couple of comrades, they were hanged, beheaded, and then their heads were placed on spikes. His head stayed on a spike for 25 years.
That is the most amazing, for me, the most amazing thing about this whole thing.
It's a long
that
time.
For 25 years, whenever you came to London, you could go and look at a head on the spike. And if you came back 25 years later, it would still be there.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. Like, I think about all the shops near my house. Most of them are less than 5 years old because they just all got...
The turnover. It was much less in those days. You got a lot of custom in the same place for a head.
Amazing.
But one person who lived through the whole thing was... Oliver Cromwell's son, Richard. So when Cromwell died, it happens so often with rulers, tyrants, newly established reigns, anyway, they try and hand over to their kids. So
let's
get
rid of the monarchy. It's ridiculous that someone could have the divine right to rule, but when I die, I want my kids to have it.
I actually do think Napoleon II is a good name for an emperor. So Richard Cromwell resigned. He was not up to the job. I mean, he was not... as zealous as his father, and he didn't have the authority. So he was kicked out in 1659, 1 year later, and he just lived out his life.
Right.
He died in 1712. I think he moved overseas.
I think if your dad's head was on a spike in London, you probably would move out of town.
You wouldn't say in London, would you?
But get this, he died in 1712. He lived an incredibly long time. So he saw the whole thing, and he was the longest-lived British head of state until... the year 2012 when he was overtaken by Queen Elizabeth
II.
Right. Really? When she was 85. So that's the age he lived to.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So for a long time, the longest lived head of state was Richard Cromwell.
That's really bizarre. Funny.
Do you know where Oliver Cromwell's head is now?
Oh, was it reburied with the rest of him?
No, this is interesting.
It was buried in Cambridge University, no?
Okay, so I read this in a Giles Brandreth book, and I tweeted him to ask him if this was true, and he tweeted me back. So I said, my memory of it goes like this. There is a relic of Oliver Cromwell kept by the chief whip or prime minister. Have I made that up? I probably have. He wrote back, it's in the drawers at Chequers. So my memory is that the skull
of Oliver Cromwell is in Chequers. Is in a drawer.
In a drawer. And I think I read it in Brandreth's autobiography, his diaries of his time as a politician, and in it he says he goes to Chequers and the drawers open and they let you see and stroke the skull. You
know, stroke the skull.
So what I have in my notes is that one day there was a storm and the head blew off the spike.
Yeah,
and they thought, you know what, it's been here for 25 years. We probably don't need to put it back up again. Everyone's seen it now.
They get the idea. Yeah, they do it again.
Exactly. And then the skull was sort of taken away and it was just kind of sold in auction after auction and went through a load of families. But then it was buried at Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge in 1960.
Wow. Interesting.
That's what I've got. But yeah. I mean, probably like with these things, there's probably 20 of those skulls around that.
And I don't specify what relic I mean. He could have thought it might have been a finger or something. In my head, it's his head.
Oh, right. Well, maybe it's not the head. That's more normal if it's a finger, because I can't think of a drawer that could even fit a skull.
Oh, I think
you can't think of a drawer that could.
I imagine.
Are you going to pull out of that?
Sure. I should pull out of that. I suppose I'm imagining a desk drawer and those old desks with tiny drawers.
Often the bottom drawer, even of a standard wooden desk, will be a bit bigger.
But even if that didn't exist, it doesn't take much imagination to take a drawer and make it slightly deeper.
My head, ironically, is not big enough to get around this concept.
Have you ever seen a filing cabinet? Because
it's too much.
Yeah. I can't take it.
So Anna's amazing Freaky Friday idea, which I actually think is a brilliant idea,
thank you,
maybe could have been true-ish, because when Cromwell's head got put on the spike, there was a big rumor around that actually it wasn't his head and that they'd mistakenly gotten the wrong one, and it was probably some old King of England. They didn't specify which one it was, because he was originally buried, was it in Westminster Abbey, I think
you're right,
Westminster Hall. So there was loads of other kings there, and they thought that they dug up the wrong thing and just put an old king's head there.
Surely you just pick the roundest head.
Brilliant. Roundhead joke. Good.
It's a roundhead joke.
I love it.
Very nice.
They did used to toss them in all together a bit. Yeah. Like, actually, there was obviously a conundrum after Charles was decapitated, because they don't want to create a martyr of him by having it either be a big thing burying him or not burying him at all. So I think they took him away to Windsor and they interred him in Henry VIII's tomb, weirdly.
Wow. Mm.
And then in 1813, they decided to dig him up again. I think this was to check
again.
He was there again.
Right. Okay.
Just the first time again.
Oh,
this
okay.
is Charles
Sorry.
First.
Yeah.
It was George III's physician, Henry Halford, who was kind of leading the exhumation. And he ended up with Charles's vertebra and some beard and some of his teeth. Mm. Which
beard.
Is, yeah, some beard.
I'm surprised the beard is still extant after all that time.
Yeah,
that seems weird, doesn't
Strong
it?
How many years are we saying?
Yeah, well, this was 1813, so it's 160 years.
What?
Yeah. So he says that they went, oh, it's not worth opening the coffin again. Do you mind just keeping these? And he kept them.
Wow.
Other people who were there say that he went in and nicked all the stuff and hung on to it. But then his grandson returned it. It was the 1890s, and he went to the Prince of Wales and said, well, look, we've got these bits of Charles I. Do you want them?
The story, the QI facts that we always say about this is that they used the vertebrae as a salt holder.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah, so if you ever went for dinner at Sir Henry Halford's house and you wanted some salt, it would be a little dish, but when you looked at it closely, it would be part of his backbone.
Wow.
That's freaky.
No, you can fit that in a cupboard. You can.
The eventual outcomes for the regicides, who were the people who'd signed the death warrant, basically, were bad. So I think a lot of them were disemboweled.
They're bad. Yeah.
They were not good.
Drawn and quartered.
They were hanged until not quite dead, and then had their genitals removed, and then were disemboweled.
Still alive.
Got to lie. But if you got away, then it could be okay. And interestingly, if you live in Connecticut, near I think in New Haven, then there are three streets called Dixwell Avenue, Wally Avenue, and Gough Street.
Dixwell. Mm-hmm.
Dixwell and Wally.
Wally. And what was the other one?
Dixwell, Wally, and Gough.
Sort of, they were the worst surveyors that I ever had for my house.
But Wally and Gough are the two that are in this book, Act of Oblivion. They're the two protagonists. Wow. Dixwell was left out, apparently.
Well, they all ended up in this place, and they liked them so much in America, obviously, because America aren't that pro-monarchy, that they named these streets after them.
It was they were in very, very religious, puritanical communities, which were already very uncertain about monarchy and wanted divine
rule. It was kind of a place where they could go, wasn't it, when they were safe. There's another place in North America named after someone connected to this story. So the wife of Charles I was Henrietta Marie. She was a French Catholic princess. She got married by proxy, which is quite cool. So Charles I wasn't there when she got married. So he had a proxy who was George Villiers, the first Duke of Buckingham. But George Villiers wasn't available either. So they got another proxy in. He was Charles de Lorraine, who was the Duke of Chevreuse. And basically, they got married with this guy pretending to be the king. And in those days, you could do that.
I think we've said before, haven't we? There were various rituals if you're married by proxy. Like, you, as the proxy, would maybe have to touch the person's thigh. I think that
happened. You have to, like, lie in bed and touch their thigh.
Lie in bed and be witness with them. Yeah.
So the king only met his wife 3 months later at Dover.
Three months later?
They'd been married for 3 months when he met her.
Awesome. That's so funny.
And one of these areas in North America where Catholics felt safe, where they could go, was named after Henrietta Marie, and it was Maryland, or Maryland, or Maryland. And we always say this name, and we always pronounce it wrong on this podcast, and the people of Maryland always write to us. But now I actually think that because it's named after Henrietta Marie, it should be called Maryland.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So that's what I will be calling it from
Excellent.
Now on.
Very nice.
Especially because she didn't like Mary, actually. No. She was French, and she was very French. And she didn't speak any English. She didn't like being called Mary.
So the English used to call her Mary as like a nickname.
And she said, no, I'm French. Mary's not my name. Don't even like the name Mary. Fair enough. Wow. Marie is a better name than Mary. IMO.
Can we talk a bit about the execution itself?
Mm. Why?
Because it was such an interesting... I mean, what an extraordinary... I mean, one of the weirdest days ever to happen in English history. You know, it was on Whitehall. It was not far from here.
Uh-huh.
So when it happened, the executioner had to wear... a disguise.
Yeah.
Because the executioner has never been identified for sure.
Do you not just mean like a hood?
No, I don't. I mean a wig, a fake beard, a sailor's costume.
Yeah, confusing details.
Unclear as to why, really? And fishnets over the face.
Okay. So
afterwards, after the restoration, there was a big manhunt for who was the exact executioner, because we're going to kill him.
Yeah.
And
must have been a lot of sailors getting rid of their fishnets just in case they thought.
Well, the executioner was never properly identified. No. One guy was sentenced to death for it, but then the sentence was overturned.
Did one guy claim to be and then wrote that they... I can't remember about that.
There's a museum in London that has a few of these relics from the execution, including a shirt that belonged to Charles I that they believe, you know, they can't actually work out properly, but all his bits of clothing were sort of torn off him and handed round.
That's
auctioned.
The Museum of London, isn't it?
The Museum of London, And among those items, they have a patched leather shoe of a man called John Big, and they believe that Big was the executioner. At least that's... one of the theories.
Mr. Big.
Mr. Big. Yeah.
That's what that whole thing... It was an analogy.
The Sex and the City
Sex
character,
the
Mr.
City
Big.
Was an analogy was about... for the English Civil War.
That's that's very interesting.
Can't believe you didn't see that.
So I guess... what's her name? Is it Carrie?
Carrie Fisher. Carrie Fishnet. But they thought that would be too obvious.
Oh, my God.
And so,
I don't think it's Carrie Fisher.
Is she called Carrie Bradshaw?
Carrie Fisher's a different person, isn't it?
Carrie Fisher.
She called Carrie Bradshaw. Yeah. Well, interestingly, John Bradshaw was the parliamentary commissioner who tried Charles I in Westminster Hall.
You are joking.
No.
I can't believe we're actually blowing this shit wide open.
This is huge.
Bradshaw and Big.
If only any of us had ever properly watched Sex and the City, we'd be all over it right now.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that in World War II, a Finnish soldier got tired in the Arctic, so took the entire platoon's rations of methamphetamine and subsequently skied 400 kilometers to safety.
Extraordinary.
It's the power of uppers.
It's insane, the story.
It's a really insane story. So this is a chap called Aimo Koivunen, and it was at a time when Finland was at war with the Soviet Union. It was mid-Second World War. Finland was sort of on Germany's side, war with the Soviet Union, and he's fighting in this very cold area with his platoon, and he had been tasked with keeping his entire group supply of Pervitin, which is meth. And it was so crucial in the Second World War. Everyone was bloody taking it. And he was really, really tired. And I think the Soviets were coming and chasing them. And he was told to, like, lead them, to make tracks and lead them away so they could escape. And he was at the front. And he said, in his memory of it, that so implausible. It's so implausible. He said, especially because, first of all, he said, I didn't want to take them because I was kind of against that. I disapproved of drugs. So I tried not to. But then I got so knackered that, look, I just tipped a pill into my hand, what I hope was a pill, but I was wearing mittens, and so quite a few came out. Turns out all 30 of the pills came out, and then because he wanted to hide what he was doing from his comrades, he just ate them all.
What, you're being shot at? It's stressful. I'm just eat them all. Eat, have all the Tic Tacs, basically. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
If you pour a lot of Tic Tacs in your hand, let's say you only want two, but accidentally five come out, you're not going to put them back in the Tic Tac.
Exactly. No. Especially if you're being shot at.
That's how you usually am when I'm eating Tic Tacs.
Just drop them in the snow. Anything.
And then it goes Sonic the Hedgehog, because suddenly just eats this.
I was thinking of Popeye. Woo! When Popeye has the spinach. Bang, bang. Suddenly.
He turns into a mutant, absolute, like, he basically, as it goes, he received the hit in one swoop. And the hit, by the way, lasts for a very long time.
When you take a normal amount of meth, it can last a few days.
But you figure he took an OD level of it, is what they say, right?
Definitely.
And I figure that the OD level would come to you in one hit. This kind of just plays out over a number of days. And he goes speeding away, and they're trying to chase him. And they eventually
collect all these rings.
Yeah. And they can't keep up, and the music goes really fast. And they're chasing him still, and he's just going off. And then this is the craziest bit, which presumably you've got more on, Anna, because I just couldn't believe it, so I stopped reading. He blacks out. He blacks out and keeps going.
Basically, a few days later, he kind of was like, oh, where am I?
Yeah.
And it turned out that he'd been doing that.
And he's still...
he may have collapsed multiple times on the way.
Yeah.
Basically,
one
of the things I found surprising in his account is that he said he felt amazing for a bit, quite a short time, I think, where he skied like Sonic the Hedgehog. And then he said, something very unexpected happened. I completely lost the plot and started hallucinating and collapsing. Mm. I would say that's not unexpected if you have taken 30 pills of meth. But then... the mystery is what happened to the people with him. And I think, because what preceded this was actually an argument between him and his men.
Mm-hmm.
And he blacks out. And the next thing he remembers, he wakes up and he's completely on his own. So one sort of suspects they had a chat and said, this guy's being so annoying right now. He's a massive liability.
Well, post-meth, him taking
post-meth,
all the pills.
Post-meth, yeah. Right.
Well, they took all his ammunition off him, didn't they?
Yeah. And his food supplies.
Yeah.
So he woke up and had nothing.
Well, then he started skiing towards some... He saw some allies in the distance and started skiing towards them. Much too late, realizes they're Russians.
Yeah.
But he's still got the drugs on him.
He skis through them and past them. He keeps going.
He said they were so confused, they just moved their... They should have shot him, and they just moved their legs out the way to let him get past.
Excuse me. Yeah. He spent all night trying to get to a distant farm window, which turned out to be the North Star.
And then didn't he survived, didn't he, by like chewing on some tree, like a cactus style.
He boiled pine needles at one point, so he still had
pine tea.
Delicious pine tea, had some pine tea, but he was really starving. It was only at the very end where he somehow had found a hut, finally, this cabin in the woods. And first of all, it's so funny. He says, I lit a fire in the middle of the cabin. It's still clearly high. So didn't know what he was doing. Lit a fire in the middle of a wooden cabin, and it just set fire to the cabin. And he said, I just sat next to the fire and followed it around as it burned the cabin down gradually.
God.
The whole cabin collapsed around him.
How many days into...
The trip. Well, he just doesn't know.
Okay.
I think about 5 days, but he has no idea. He only realized when he came out of it had been 2 weeks. And on his like last day, he was about to starve to death, and a jay flew past, and he whacked it with his ski pole and ate a raw jay.
Mm.
Again, not the actions of someone who's completely with it. I mean, the ability to beat a bird out of the sky is unusual.
With a stick, that's hard.
With a stick.
It's really hard.
Those ski poles are quite thin.
People don't go on pheasant shoots with just a ski pole, do they? And there is a reason.
Well, they're pros, yeah, yeah. Was this before or after he got blown up? Sorry.
That was after.
Because he hit
the, so he was set on fire and then he was blown up and then he had the J, right?
Yeah, I think so. Because he found another little building. I said it was a German post. But the Germans had retreated from it and they had attached mines to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he basically shredded his entire foot in the first explosion. And then he sort of hopped around and he opened a door. And then that was also mined. Mm-hmm. And supposedly he came to about, you know, many meters away. He'd been blasted across, but he was still holding the doorknob like in a cartoon.
It's the most extraordinary story.
Do we think true?
I can't imagine any of it's true. I think he was sitting at home.
Because we knew he was anti-drugs, right? Maybe he's come up with all this as a don't do drugs story.
Yeah, big bit propaganda.
This is like a Finnish 40s talk to Frank thing.
Yes. Yeah. I think we know from his associates that the first bit happened and the last bit happened. But I suppose the only account we have of the in-between bit is his.
Yeah. With a guy with a lot of drugs in his body. Yeah. That's all we've got. But
he must have had a shredded foot, right?
Yeah, he had
and he must have been holding
foot.
A doorknob.
Must have had a bloody ski pole with him.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, dead Jay.
He just kind of looked at all these things and like, right, I'm going to have to make a story up about these.
But anyway, somehow he made it. I mean, eventually he was found by his allies, who were the Germans or the Finnish, and taken to hospital. And
apparently his heart rate was still 200 beats per minute at that stage.
It's a lot.
It's incredible he lived.
It's extraordinary.
And then he sort of ripe old age, you know, he just sort of war ended.
In his 70s,
Anyway, it was mad. But the use of meth was big, wasn't it? The Germans were particularly into it.
Yeah.
But everyone did it.
Well, I was reading you could get these pills called Forced March, which were quite common, even like at the start of the 20th century. So they were a blend of cocaine and caffeine. I mean, I don't know why you need the caffeine at the point where you've had all the cocaine, but it was basically, it was sold publicly. It was sold by the Wellcome, actually, or by Burroughs Wellcome, who was one of the Wellcome family.
Oh, really?
It was a pharmaceutical family there, yeah.
They took them to the Antarctic expeditions, the Forced March. Yeah, yeah. Scott cocaine, and Shackleton.
Oh, really?
But they took specifically Forced March, which I think they've got to market it in a gentler way, or maybe that's what you want, is Forced March.
I think that's
March.
What you need in motivation, right? Yeah. It's like, I can't march anymore.
Yeah, you're right.
Had some Forced March. And did they use that? Because they use that, the Germans use that in the war. Did the Brits use that as well, and the Allies generally?
I think
there was meth used all around.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
The definitely. Meth pills that were synthesized in the 30s.
But maybe not for everybody, for people who, I mean, obviously not for everybody, but, you know, as in maybe it would be for pilots rather than for standard infantry.
I think it was pilots to stay awake. I think that's why the Allies use it, for sure.
That's so interesting.
So off the back of this, I was just looking into supplies that you take in the Arctic, what you have to keep you going. And I mean, it seems like it was either cocaine or biscuits. As in, they were like...
It sounds like a student's fantasy, doesn't it?
You're right.
What's on offer today? Same.
Okay, so, like, get this. Captain Scott, right? Scott of the Antarctic.
Yeah.
Who did loads of expeditions there. He took some specially made biscuits, which were glucose enriched, and they're made by a firm called Huntley & Palmer. But he set off with digestive, rich tea, petit beurre, fancy lunch, ginger nuts, as well as emergency Antarctic and small captain biscuits. And later in his trip, he got resupplied with more biscuits.
Cool.
I actually think that they're some of the worst biscuits you've just named, like digestives and rich tea.
Ginger nuts,
hobnobs, and the
Jammy Dodger.
Jammy Dodger.
Did we have that?
Well, tragically,
then?
This was a pre-Jammy Dodger world. I mean, maybe he would have made it back if he had some Jammy Dodgers.
On the first all-female expedition to the North Pole, every woman involved ate 4 penguins per day.
Wow.
They don't have penguins in the Arctic.
They brought
penguins from the Antarctic to the Arctic solely to mince them up and eat them.
Yeah, they're cruel, and that's why they haven't sent women back to the North Pole. This is, of course, biscuit penguins. They were sponsored by McVitie's, and so McVitie's provided them with, hard to nail down the number, but thousands of penguins, I believe, and one of the women said they were told to eat 4 penguins a day.
Interesting. According to the biography Frigid Women by Sue Riches and Victoria Riches.
Brilliant.
So this was two of the women who went on it. They were given 6 biscuits per person per day for the expedition.
Oh, really? Maybe the person who I read, they got their biscuits nicked before they gave them to her.
Yeah, that could be it. Four.
It's interesting because that many, it must have been loads of days they were travelling.
It was a relay, so it meant that 4 women minute at a time were going, and then they would be airlifted out, and the next lot would be airlifted into wherever they were.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking you could wear the biscuits as a kind of extra layer of warmth, but maybe,
wear
maybe
the
not.
Biscuits?
Well, like you could make it, because they're quite flat, aren't they? You
penguins,
kind of make it,
yeah.
You could have a waistcoat that was lined with penguins.
And actually, they're two biscuits, and in between, there's like a little bit of chocolate or something, mm-hmm. right?
What, so insulation, you're
insulate,
thinking?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Where the it just sounds like you're one of the members on the trip who misheard where are the biscuits. You've emerged covered in penguins.
What year was this, by the way?
It was 1997. Ah. And so I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Remembering that it's 1997 and they're British and thinking what was happening in 1997 at the time, what do you think the newspapers nicknamed them?
Something to do with Tony Blair.
Blair's frozen women.
Go away from politics. Go to culture.
The Spice Girls were big.
And they were in the Arctic.
Yeah, so...
Frozen spices?
No.
Wait, say it again. Say the ingredients.
The Spice Girls were big.
Yep.
They're going to the North Pole. What nickname?
Girl Polar.
Zig Arctic. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
Girl Polar.
Wanna be the North Poles. No. Two become... 16 become...
Literally everyone
baby.
Listening has got this.
Okay. All right. Well done, everyone.
What do you get in the Arctic?
Snow.
As well as snow.
Ice.
Icy Spice. Ice Girls.
The Ice Girls.
Pew, pew, pew.
Nice one, Dad.
Wow, straight in there.
Old Sonic Shriver.
That's incredible.
And one of the patrons of the Ice Girls was Dawn French, the comedian. And she told the press that she'd actually made the cut to be on the expedition, but she decided to stay at home and comfort all the husbands.
That's so good. Very nice.
One of the husbands dumped his wife while she was out there.
No, yeah. While she was out there?
Yeah.
She's married to Dawn French now.
What? Was it Lenny Henry?
It was, yeah. This is Anne, who had triplets, and she'd never had any experience before. She's this amazing explorer now. Anne Daniels, never done anything before. But she, when they finished the expedition, all the other women had letters from home, and she didn't have one, and it was a sign that her husband had decided to divorce her.
Oh my God. Did you guys hear about Rosie Stancer?
Is she one of the...
She's one of the Arctic, one of the frigid women, as the book has it. So she was on it. So get this, she's I think she's quite quite posh, like her grand
posh ice.
brilliant. So, and she like Anne Daniels, she went on to do a load of other expeditions. She did one, the Snickers South Pole Solo and the Mars North Pole Solo. So these are all chocolate and biscuit sponsored.
Brilliant.
But her grandfather was also a wannabe, thank you, explorer. He was the fourth Earl of Granville, right?
Yeah.
And he wanted to be a polar explorer, but he was thwarted. Can you guess why? It was something about his body.
He had a weird sort of inner ear thing that whenever he wanted to go north, he always went south.
That's a very creative one. Better than what I've got. Shall I tell you?
Yeah.
He was too tall
to
go to on an...
Because you hit your head on the top of the earth.
Because he wouldn't fit in the tent. He was too tall for the tent.
So his feet would be sticking out.
Yeah, and that would obviously kill all the men in the tent with cold.
Could he not do like the kind of the embryo position?
Yeah. He was. I mean, maybe this was an excuse and it was his personality, but he was told he was too tall to fit in the expedition tent.
I'm only 5'8". Yeah. No, too tall.
Could you get a bigger tent? Yeah,
no, they don't exist. My cobnobs. Can't bring something that doesn't exist, mate.
I can't believe you just called the fetal position the embryo position.
I know, I couldn't remember.
Embryo position.
Yeah. We've got a phrase for that.
So I read a story which is that Anne Daniels, mother of triplets, one of her things to keep her going was to just say her kids' names over and over again out loud. The triplets just repeat their names.
Baby Ice.
But they had very near-death experiences. It was so hairy.
Scary ice.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay, let me just... I've crossed off three. We've got two more to get. Yeah. Done posh, we've done baby. Scary, and we've done baby. So that leaves
sporty
and
ginger.
Ginger. Wait. They didn't take ginger nuts. They took the penguins.
Yeah.
Damn it.
They're all sporty.
Okay.
But, yeah, the daughter rung her mum to say, hey, I'm doing this Arctic expedition. And the mum says her daughter invited her. The daughter says she definitely didn't invite her mum, but her mum decided to go. But they both fell through the ice at one point. So the Arctic moves. They didn't quite realise how much when you're exploring. It shifts and moves and the ice was creaking and they're wearing skis and they both fell through the ice and had to like swim in skis.
What?
And she said she just remembered, while also towing these supply wagons, they all had a supply wagon they had to tow behind them.
And they survived?
Them. Yeah, they somehow survived. Incredibly. But then it sounds like God was watching, because they ended up, two of them ended up managing to climb out onto one side of the ice, but their group was on the other. So they were on either side of a river, and they just walked either side of this river, and they were getting more and more divergent, and they realized they were not going to be able to get back to each other. Mm. And then suddenly the ice started moving and the river closed up.
Ooh,
and wow. The ice joined together.
Wow.
But it would have been very precarious, as in to walk across that is quite nerve-wracking. You would have had to tread, you would have had to walk quite gingerly. Spice.
Ice.
James saw that coming from such a distance.
I know.
What's that on the horizon? Is it the North Pole? No, it's Andy's joke.
Oh, it doesn't feel as good when you get there.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that the crowd science expert who designed and mapped out the Q is called Professor Keith Still.
Did you try and say Keith? It sounds like Keep.
Yeah. So his name's Keith Still. It looks like Keep Still when you say it in a weird way.
Yeah.
And what's the Qs do?
They move, don't they?
Yeah.
But this one famously was a very long one that required Keith Still.
No, it actually required you to keep walking for about 5 miles.
It did. But what were you doing when you weren't walking?
I suppose you would keep still.
That's right.
Like they always say Keith Still.
Oh, God. This is the cue for Elizabeth II.
This is the passing of the Queen. There was this extraordinary cue that lasted somewhere between 5 miles onwards. Yeah. And if you were in it, if you were someone who came to London to be part of it, you could be waiting between 9 and 24 hours to eventually get to the front of the queue. Professor Keith Still is no, someone who helps.
You can say his name normally now we've done the facts. Yeah. It's okay.
No, we've explained the joke, which almost works. Now let's just call him by his name.
So he is from Burton and Kendall in Cumbria, and his job is a crowd scientist. So for the last 30 years, he's been doing this as a job, and he was the person who was in charge of creating a line that was going to be one that meant that people felt safe and that they had toilet stops along the way, and he had to, and you know, medical assistance, and he had to devise it for something that was twice the length.
Where would it have gone?
I don't know. I'm not sure if
into
we were
into the English Channel when you drop into the English Channel. Yeah. Well,
because they did stop it at one point. They said we're at capacity, so they didn't use the proposed route. But then what they had was a pen where a sort of secondary queue started, where you could then go from that second queue
for the queue.
Queue for the queue, exactly.
God, I remember that happened. I didn't go clubbing very much as a student.
You astonishing.
No, it's true. But there was, I think partly because one of the first times I went.
Your friends said you were too tall, didn't they?
Yeah, apparently the club had a very low ceiling. And
they always do.
Yeah. I would have hated it. Yeah. No, there was a club called The Bridge, which was you'd go to.
Yeah.
And there was you'd queue up for ages, and I did queue up for ages, and then I got in, and it turned out that the club I got into was actually a queue for the actual club.
No.
There was this whole and it had a bar and everything, but it was basically the queue for The Bridge, as in you'd get given a ticket, and when they called out certain tickets, you could go into the actual club. But I queued for about 40 minutes to get into the queue club.
You
which
must
was
feel
rubbish.
Like an absolute chump. I've been to The Bridge multiple times. I don't remember the old double queue.
Oh, well, Anna probably walks up to the front and says, "I'm Anna Tashinsky."
Yeah, they let me in the back.
And
usually.
You're DJing. Yeah.
It is That's actually cool. quite impressive. The level of standing.
All right.
So I hadn't really thought about the fact that you would be actually standing up, because you are constantly moving, so you can't really sit down. You were standing up for 24 hours. And lots of people needed medical treatment. 291 people needed medical assistance just on one day, with 17 having to go to hospital.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Dehydrating and fainting. It is quite a lot.
Of course, they could have just not had a queue. I mean, these days we do have systems to stop people from having to queue for miles and miles and miles.
What, like booking in?
Yeah, you could have just gone on the website, said, "I'm going to come between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock," and then the queue would never have gotten longer than an
Where's
hour.
Where's the fun in that? What would the news have done for a week?
That's the point, isn't it? The point is that it's like this ceremonial thing that they wanted to show how important it was and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Professor Still. He got into queuing, first of all, several decades ago. He was at a Freddie Mercury gig. It was an AIDS awareness gig, and it was at Wembley, and he and his friends, they were stuck in the queue for hours, and his friends were all quite annoyed, and he was quite mathematically minded and thought, God, really interesting, actually. And so he got into queuing, and he then his sort of first...
interestingly queuing for the Queen.
Yeah,
and queuing for Queen.
Oh my God. We've blown the shit wide open. his next thing he did, he went to Wembley Stadium, and he got special permission from the whoever's running the grounds, and he would spend his weekends for ages sitting above the players' tunnel, watching the crowds.
Oh,
the match was going on, but he's not watching it.
I think he wouldn't have been paying any attention to the match. Yeah, and you've just seen this guy sitting above the
He can't. He said of the queue, the one, the recent queue, he would not have been able to have withstand the length of time it required to get to the front. Really? He himself can no longer queue within
even
the queues he decides.
Well, yeah, because he's old.
He's got an arthritic hip.
That must require him to keep still more often than he'd like.
Absolutely.
It's funny because he's got a lovely website, and he lists his hobbies on it.
Does he? Oh, I didn't see his website.
Oh, yeah, it's a great website. Yeah, he owns multiple motorbikes, and he plays bowls.
Does he?
Yeah, it's quite a rare combo, I think, like having a Harley Davidson and playing Crown Green bowls.
Is it?
Well, one seems
quite
hardcore.
No, you're right,
Hell's
Angels, they were famous for their bowls match. Yeah.
Sorry, they're the only people at motorbike. I forgot that as well.
He's got a big Harley Davidson. He's got a... You don't think
I associate both with real ale pubs.
I bet he bloody loves a real ale. Yeah. Some other animals, queue. I didn't know this.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
ants, probably, I reckon. Ants.
Yeah, must do. Yeah. Fish, queue. There are fish which queue. Yeah, there are they're small goby fish, right? They have this thing where they have a mating queue. Okay, this is a bit sexy, actually. So only the top male and female mate, right? And all the other females have to wait in a queue before they can have sex. I think with the top male, but maybe it's actually there's a queue of males. I don't know.
Okay,
but basically, to organise the queue, they do it by a pecking order of like sexiness, and sexiness is body mass for them. So the biggest female is the sexiest one and gets to have sex first, right?
Okay.
And then the next biggest and so on. And they can measure. You know how in school you had to line up for fire drills and things with a height order?
Did you?
Okay.
We did, yeah.
But you're not too tall for that.
I was always left to burn, weirdly. But the fish can tell their body mass, right? So if the difference is 5%, more than 5% of their body mass, like between one female and the next, they will queue neatly, right? And because they know who's bigger, they can see.
Well, because they've all got scales, haven't they?
Brilliant. But if the difference is smaller than 5% between two females in the queue, the smaller one will try and queue jump, and we'll sort of say there's a small enough difference. I think I could do it.
Yeah.
And then the bigger one will drive it out of the group. We'll sort of force it out of the queue. They'll have a fight.
Right. What if in during that fight they both lose weight?
This is what they it's similar to that. Smaller fish will sometimes adjust their own size. They will lose weight to avoid presenting a challenge to the fish that's bigger than them. So they don't get in a fight and they don't queue jump. They say, right, I'll just shrink my own body.
How
so
do they
that
do
I'm
that?
I guess they don't eat for a while.
Oh, in the lead up to the queue. Not as in okay.
Yeah.
Not on the spot. They can't do
they can't shit off everything else.
Yeah.
No.
Famous queue when McDonald's opened in Moscow.
Oh yeah.
In 1990. People queued for 6 hours to get a McDonald's.
Wow.
And they served 30,000 people on the first day. And one Big Mac cost 3.75 rubles.
Okay.
And a monthly wage was 150 rubles. So that is the equivalent today of a Big Mac costing £52.78.
Wow.
Yeah, and people queued for 6 hours to get that.
Jeez. It's because if someone tells you it's that expensive, you think it must be worth
it. Exactly.
Yeah, there was 700 seats inside and 200 outside of this McDonald's in Pushkinskaya Square. And so 900 people, that's about the same as the Globe Theatre. It was the largest McDonald's in the world until McDonald's left Russia.
Wow. But in a sense, isn't McDonald's really the theatre sort of space for...
Keep going, you'll get
you know,
there.
It's like the...
I've got no idea what you're saying.
I'm wondering where you're going
with
this.
I believe in him.
Sort of,
he can do this.
You know, what do you see at McDonald's late night? You see drama.
Yeah.
You go to a McDonald's, all human life is there. See, kind of like a theatre.
Macbeth is a...
Macbeth. I love Macbeth.
There's so much there for you, Andy.
That was what you were going for.
I feel like I did a lot of work in the midfield there. And then just slotted it home.
The Shearer of your jokes. We did on QI once that the way we load aeroplanes is totally wrong. So you know when you get your waiting for a plane and they say, if you're in rows 50 to 70, please come forward now. And they load from the back first, which seems to make sense.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's the least efficient way to do it. It's way more efficient just to say, everyone randomly get on the plane.
go!
Run for your lives.
Close the door in 4 minutes. Go!
You mean the EasyJet system?
Yeah. Leave the kids, go!
Well, the great thing is if you have kids, you get to the front of the queue.
Yeah, although that is one of the best ways to do it is to make sure the slow loaders, i.e. people with kids, get on first.
Mm. That's why they do it, I guess.
But yeah, this is, someone studied it mathematically and realised that loading from the back is actually slower than doing it randomly because people bunch up and they block each other, but you're not loading the empty spaces. And actually, one really good way to do it is do window seats, then aisle seats, then middle seats.
Oh, cool.
Vice versa.
That's mad.
I mean, it is an insane way of doing
That's insane.
Because you're with, let's say you're three people going on a plane, a family.
Yeah.
All right. Just dad first.
Yeah. Now the four-year-old on their own.
Okay. Families aside, I do think that is a cool way of doing it because then everyone's slotted, everyone goes to the end of their row where the windows are and no one's faffing about in the corridor bit of the plane.
They're slowly, not doing it on purpose, Andy. They just need to get their bags into the...
I'm not sure the window seat knocks that out because you still need to get your bag into the top bit.
Well, I think the key thing to do is everyone just carries the bag with them and just holds it in their arms until the plane's taken off. Then you can put it up in the racks above.
I don't think you're allowed to hold the bags in your arms, especially if you're on a like an emergency exit seat.
Yeah, that's true.
You've got to put that under your feet, I'm afraid. Okay. The seat in front of you.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, well, don't fly.
I was reading a website called Line Logic, and they specialize in looking at public guidances and line management solutions. And so they go into businesses and try and sort out how they can best manage their crowds and stuff. Right. And they say that the word faffing directly relates to the idea of getting to the front of a queue and then waiting for that person who's just in front of you who's paid to sort of gather their things together. The faffing that they do of sort of like putting their wallet back and stuff.
Well, like that's the first instance of the word faffing.
It's what this website says.
What is this website? Who are these people?
It's Line Logic.
What are their credentials?
I'm Beckham. That's great.
But they say that faffing time takes roughly 3.17 seconds. That's the average faff that you'll have. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's plausible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can pride yourself on being a non-faffer once you're at the front of a queue.
Yeah.
Like, right now I've got my wallet. I'm ready to put the card away. I'm ready to grab the thing. Go. You know.
Yes.
Or you can faff.
Yeah.
I
wonder which you are, Andy.
Yeah.
I pride myself on my non-faffing.
You
non-faffing.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, you guys were expecting that. I see.
It felt like a weighted survey when you explain the difference between the two.
No, because they do say some people are absolutely awesome and they always know exactly how to leave a checkout.
Then you get these complete arseholes.
Yeah. Well, I panic. I'm annoying the people behind me, basically.
Yeah.
So I think time when you've finished your transaction feels, you know, longer to you.
I agree. Oh, God, I often rush off without my shopping. I'm scared.
But I feel you're the type of personality that would want to make sure that was acknowledged. And then so you would somehow waste the person behind you's time going,
wait, why am
no
I
worries, getting out of your way there so quickly.
Just don't worry. Just another day being a hero.
Yeah. I reckon you'd just go, beep.
Yeah.
Oh, 3 seconds, 24. Yeah. Very good.
Enjoy that extra second I've saved you.
Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @Schreiberland, Andy.
@AndrewHunterM.
James.
@JamesHarkin.
And Anna.
You can email podcast.qi.com.
Yep, or go to our group account, which is @NoSuchThing, or our website, NoSuchThingAsAFish.com. Check out all the previous episodes up there. Also, check out Club Fish, the exciting, hidden behind-the-scenes membership club where we put extra content, extra fun shows, and you'll also get ad-free episodes. Check it out now and join today. Otherwise, come back next week. We're going to be back with another episode, and we will see you then. A goodbye.